Our second case this morning is United States against White. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Chief Judge Efron and judges of this honorable court, may it please the court, I'm Captain Philip Corman, and along with Colonel Eric Eklund, I represent the appellant, Major Shontae White. This case is both about an ambiguous Air Force credentialing form and about a criminal defendant's right under the Due Process Clause to present relevant defense evidence and to have a fair trial. Your Honors, if I may, I'd like to start first in reverse order from the issues that were in the brief and cover first the ruling regarding the lay opinions and then discuss the Army credentialing forms.
Please proceed.
In this case, the military judge abused his discretion in excluding relevant and material lay opinions. These opinions were offered by individuals who were familiar with the credentialing form, the Air Force Form 1540, which was designed for providers in the Air Force. All three of these individuals interpreted the relevant question on this form as whether the applicant had been a defendant in a felony or misdemeanor case during their practice time frame.
What difference does that make? The judge kept it out because there was no evidence that the appellant had discussed this form or its claimed ambiguities with any of these people before filling it out. This is a specific intent offense. She has to do this with the intent to deceive. How is their testimony at all relevant to whether she had the intent to deceive when she didn't talk to them ahead of time before she filled this form out?
Your Honor, the lay opinions referred to the question at issue and exposed the ambiguities about this question.
Well, wait a minute. Now you seem to be conflating these two. You were talking about ambiguity and you were talking about the right to present evidence.
Yes, what are
we talking about here?
What
would these people have offered?
These individuals would offer a reasonable interpretation of the question that may not be immediately obvious to the lay members. These forms are specific to providers, and these individuals had extensive experience filling these forms out.
How is that relevant any more than if I had offered that opinion? She never talked to any of these people before. How is this relevant to her intent or her understanding of the form?
These lay opinions go to the meaning of the question and therefore reflect on whether the response on the form was false or not.
Counsel, is your underlying point one in which the argument is that the form is ambiguous as a matter of law, that is, in the way that we might interpret a contract or a regulation, or is your argument that as a matter of practice, the form was interpreted a particular way by people who were similarly situated to the accused, the appellant in this case?
Your Honor, I think it's the former. I think this court can look at the particular form, to the best of my understanding of your question, and come to a conclusion that there is some ambiguity. The form itself appears to be somewhat chronological in its development, and under the heading of practice history, there's this question amid a bunch of questions that are clearly related to practice. It's almost as if all these items in Section 8 under practice history, it's almost as if the individual can interpret and imply during your practice history, have you ever lost your clinical privileges? Have you ever been in a misdemeanor or conviction?
But what if we were to conclude that if we were interpreting this as a regulation, it would be unambiguous? Do you lose under those circumstances? Did that preclude the defense from introducing expert testimony, or excuse me, the lay testimony from those similarly situated?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't. In that case, the defense should be able to present relevant testimony about alternate interpretations of this question. And that's a matter for the fact finder the panel members to decide whether she had what the question was asking for and whether her answer was false and whether she had an intent to deceive. In this case, the lay opinions contribute in a positive way to the defense's case, and it exposes the reasonableness of an alternative interpretation. This met the low threshold of relevance, Your Honors. In addition, the erroneous exclusion of this relevant evidence was prejudicial and constitutional error. The trial counsel posited an argument, a literal interpretation of the question, and this lay opinion testimony would offer an alternate interpretation, which is based on the context of the question.
Do you have any case law support for these propositions, for the proposition regarding lay testimony?
Your Honor, I don't. In particular, I do have the Byrd case, which is somewhat different from this case because it involved the interpretation of incoherent communications and a third party interpreting the meaning of oral communication, or actually written communications.
Well, actually, wasn't the point in that case and in other cases on this specific area that you can't have lay testimony as to what something means unless it is incomprehensible, incoherent, ambiguous?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so isn't then the question, if we apply that case law, whether this question on its face, whether the question is ambiguous, such that we need to have someone come and tell us what it means?
Yes, Your Honor. And
So what is ambiguous about the word ever?
Well, Your Honor, it's the actual placement of the question under practice history.
Well, she answered the same way in the SF-86, where it's not under practice history.
Your Honor, that was a fundamentally different question. That presupposes whether she understood at the time she filled that form out in 2007 that she knew that she had been charged with a felony more than two decades earlier when she was a teenager.
Well, what about her 1995 credentialing document in which she answered that question yes in the health credentialing form?
Your Honor, at that time she had not been licensed as a practitioner, and subsequently she became licensed, and in 1996 through 2002 she filled out the Army credentialing forms, which certainly didn't have that conviction question, but nonetheless they're reflective of the credentialing process and the types of questions that she was accustomed to answering. Similar to the Woolheater and McAllister cases, where a defendant has been precluded from presenting material evidence that is relevant to their defense, there has been a violation of the Due Process Clause. In this case, the exclusion of the lay testimony, which would have exposed the ambiguity of this question for the members and shown the reasonableness of this alternate testimony, served to bolster the appellant's primary defense, which was this alternate interpretation of this question. And
just to be clear, this issue goes to the 1540 and not the ECAMP, right?
Yes, Your Honor. And in this case, the erroneous exclusion thwarted the defense's attempts to expose reasonable doubt about the meaning of the question and whether appellant's response was false, and from that, her intent. Therefore, the erroneous exclusion of this evidence was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. In this case, the military judge excluded all the lay testimony that was offered on this question, which was fundamental to the specification two of the additional charge. I also point out, Judge Ryan, that Military Rule Evidence 701 permits lay testimony when there is a statement that is based on the witness's rational perception, and it would be helpful to the members. And in this case, certainly having a member who was a member of the credentialing function and someone who was a credentialing manager, certainly that would provide a perspective that would be helpful to the members who may not be familiar with this Air Force Form 1540, which is specific to the medical field.
Was the form before the members?
Yes, Your Honor, it was.
Okay.
Turning to the second issue, if I may, the military judge abused his discretion by excluding the six relevant and material Army credentialing forms. These forms were relevant and helpful to the defense to show the appellant's mental state regarding the credentialing process and to illustrate the type of practice-related questions that she was accustomed to answering as a licensed provider. note, a license provider from 1996 through 2002. At that point, appellant was serving in the Army as a certified, licensed social worker. In addition, this evidence is material and vital for her case, as they provide clues about what she understood the types of questions she was expected to answer as part of her credentialing. Really, these forms focus on the practice-related matters, and a vast majority of the questions on these forms from 1996 to 2002 ask questions such as, have you lost any privileges? Have there been any medical malpractice claims against you?
Did the excluded forms ask about criminal violations?
No, Your Honor, they didn't.
That was the reason he kept them out, was it not?
Yes, Your Honor.
How's that an abuse of discretion when he let in the ones that did ask that?
Again, Your Honor, the ones he let in was in 1995, and the time frame from 1996 to 2002, although they didn't have the conviction question, nonetheless, they revealed the types of questions that she later saw again in 2006. A lot of them were practice-related, and they formed her impression of the credentialing process once she became a licensed.
How's that an abuse of discretion?
Because it was clearly erroneous for the military judge in this case not to allow the defense to show her mental state about the credentialing process.
How does that go to her mental state?
A lot of the questions that were asked had to do with credentialing matters while she was in practice. That appears to be the focus of much of the questions on these Army forms which he had completed during the 96 to 2002 time frame. Although one of the forms, the 1998 form, was different from the other forms. The members might reasonably conclude from appellant's mental state when completing the Air Force 1540 that she was influenced by her past credentialing experiences when she saw this different question about serving as had she been a defendant in a felony or misdemeanor case while she was in practice, may have interpreted this question in light of her previous credentialing experiences, which the military judge did not allow in. In fact, again, there was a considerable overlap in the questions on these Army forms and on the surrounding questions in Section 8 of the Air Force Form 1540 in issue. Such forms were helpful to the defense in exposing reasonable doubt about whether she had the intent to deceive when she completed the answers the way she did.
Well, what about the security questionnaire? I mean, obviously your argument has more resonance when it comes to the credentialing forms, but the security questionnaire has nothing to do with medicine.
Yes, Your Honor. The security questionnaire actually is a different question, and again, it presupposes that she was aware of that she'd been charged with a felony 20 years ago, decades ago, which, the evidence is pretty scant on that in the record. It doesn't exist, Your Honor.
So your response to that is that she just wasn't aware of what she'd been charged with?
It was a different question, circumstantially distinguishable, Your Honor. In this case, the erroneous exclusion of the six Army credentialing forms were erroneous, and they were not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. In both of these cases, if you should find that the exclusion of the lay opinions or the exclusion of the Army credentialing forms were non-constitutional errors, then under the Kerr test, these erroneous exclusions substantially influenced the findings. Looking first at the strength of the government's case, it was a case that was based primarily on circumstantial evidence, and it is compromised by the appellant's admission to the military, at least in 1995, about this prior conviction. And there was no underlying financial motive in this alleged false official statement. In addition, there was an alternate theory that was supported by the lay opinion testimony, as well as a lack of Air Force instruction or written directions interpreting this ambiguous question. Lastly, the evidence here was quality. The lay opinions were from individuals with substantial interaction with this form, and the Air Force forms were written in appellant's own handwriting and certainly can reflect on her mental state. So under the non-constitutional error under the ruling in Kerr, under that rule, the erroneous exclusions of this evidence substantially influenced the findings, as there was no substitute for this excluded evidence at trial. In closing, when the appellant sought to defend herself against alleged false official statement, she sought to expose reasonable doubt about whether the statement she made was false and whether it was made with the intent to deceive. The erroneous exclusions in this case were not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and if you should find that they were non-constitutional error, it substantially influenced the findings. If there are no further questions, I respectfully ask this court to set aside the specification 2 of the additional charge and order a sentence rehearing.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Efron, may it please the court. I am Captain Charles Warren, and along with Colonel Don Christensen, we represent the United States in this matter. Your Honors, neither the military rules of evidence nor the United States Constitution create a right for the accused to present irrelevant evidence. Accordingly, the military judge properly excluded the irrelevant lay opinion testimony and unrelated U.S. Army medical credentialing forms in this case.
Going to the lay testimony.
Yes, Your Honor.
How is that irrelevant? These folks were involved in the credentialing process just like the appellant. They'd filled out these forms, the Air Force form, the specifically Air Force form, probably more than once. They knew their understanding of the form. How doesn't that, assuming arguendo that 701 lays a pretty low test for this kind of thing, why shouldn't that have gone in?
Yes, Your Honor. Precisely because, for the reasons the military judge identified, Your Honor, these statements about their subjective confusion as to this question had no bearing on the fact of consequence in this case, which is her subjective confusion as to this question. These statements were, at best, had conditional relevance if they had had a legal nexus, a factual nexus, rather, between her state of mind when she was filling out the form, not her state of mind when she was afterwards when she finished filling out the form. What is occurring in this case with the appellant's offering of this lay opinion testimony is an attempt to substitute one person's subjective confusion for another. And quite simply, we do not determine subjective intent by means of a public referendum, which is essentially the invitation that the appellant was giving the military judge in this case. Let's survey my three favorite providers and see what they have to say about their confusion in this, and then substitute that into my interpretation of this form. Their opinions could have been relevant given a proper factual nexus, but the only way to communicate that in this case would have been with some sort of evidence of the accused cognitions, either through her statements to others or her taking the stand personally. And that's not a burden shift, Your Honor. That's just a litigation choice that the accused made, that the appellant made in this case. Was there a follow-up question, Your Honor?
There is not.
Okay. Returning to, would the court prefer to stick with the lay opinion?
What would the accused have testified to?
Your Honor, in this case, we're told through the clemency matters of the accused that the accused would testify that she was confused as to the meaning of this question based upon its placement in the form. The government would note that as these matters come to the attention of the court, as they do through clemency, that these were not facts before the court, right, and not facts before the military judge. Therefore, he had, and judging the abuse of discretion standard, he must evaluate the military judge by the theory.
What I'm getting at is a question of what would have been relevant for the accused to testify to. That is, the accused could testify that she found the form to be confusing.
Yes, Your Honor.
Could the accused have testified to this is a form that practitioners in this area find to be not necessarily confusing, but one that we answer in a particular way? Could she have testified to that?
Your Honor, arguably in this case, that testimony would have been irrelevant because the issue is not whether it was reasonable for others to find this confusing, but whether her subjective intent in answering this question was to answer it falsely or affirmatively.
So that she, the judge could, would have excluded if she said, if she were to offer testimony that this is the way practitioners in the area interpret this question, and I followed standard practice, the trial counsel could have objected to that, and in your view, the judge would have properly excluded it.
Yes, Your Honor, because that would have been evidence of general intent versus specific intent, and general intent is not a defense in this false official statement case.
Why is that not bearing on her specific intent? Would that have not been bearing on her specific intent if her specific intent, her argument, I believe, would have been in that situation, or her position would have been that she filled it out with the specific intent to follow the practice that other practitioners followed in that area?
Well, Your Honor, the testimony that she filled it out as other practitioners would still doesn't go to the heart of the question, heart of the matter, which is whether she herself found this unambiguous and necessitating the response that she gave. It would seek to shield her subjective intent underneath others' reasonable mistakes. And the factual presentation in this case, Your Honor, indicates that she had no subjective confusion here based upon her prior answering of a substantially similar question on the Army credentialing form, which was also embedded in what might be deemed a practice history context given the surrounding questions, and her omission of an answer in 2005, followed by her...
Yeah, that's not answering my question. My question is, on the issue of specific intent, is it the government's view that a person cannot produce evidence of what the practice is with respect to answering a question, that practice being relevant to an individual's specific intent to follow the same practice in a particular case?
Your Honor, potentially that could be relevant, but the factual nexus would have to be that she understood this at the time, and there was no factual nexus to establish.
How else could one show that other than taking the stand?
Yes, Your Honor, but that is distinct from the decision to take the stand or not take the stand did not create an impermissible burden shift in this case. It created a litigation choice for the appellant.
If the government's view is that the judge would exclude the evidence that practitioners in this area answered the question in a particular way, and the judge would exclude it because the accused hasn't taken the stand to show that she answered the question that way, why isn't that a burden shift?
Well, Your Honor, because there are some evidence is relevant on its face, other evidence is only conditionally relevant given another activating event. The conditionally relevant, it's not unconstitutional for the government, for the military judge to deny the admission of conditionally relevant evidence. There's cases like this when the most relevant evidence would be in the specific intent of the appellant, her personal testimony. That does not mean that she has to take the stand, but it does mean when she does not take the stand that there may be litigation consequences. In this case, that she chooses not to present the most relevant evidence to the members as a matter of strategy to prevent cross-examination.
And why is most relevant the standard as to what is relevant?
Well, Your Honor, it's not, the most relevant isn't always a standard for basic relevance, but under the unique circumstances of this case, because these other statements were conditionally relevant at best, it requires a situation where a nexus was required to be laid and no nexus was established.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. Now, Your Honors, turning to the Army credentialing forms, which were excluded by the military judge in this case, put simply, how the appellant answered a handful of credentialing forms from 1996 to 2002, none of which contained the question of which she's convicted of answering falsely in this case, simply has no legitimate bearing on her subjective intent to deceive in answering the question on the Air Force credentialing form. While appellant relies upon the Byrd case for the proposition that lay opinion testimony could be necessary in explaining an ambiguous form, there's no evidence here that this question was ambiguous in itself. It's straightforward, placed on an Air Force 1540 form. It's in English. It's, have you ever been a defendant in a felony or misdemeanor case? That statement is not ambiguous on its face. It doesn't come near the level of the coded type communication that the court addressed in Byrd, and explaining some of those situations where lay opinion testimony would be helpful and relevant to the members in explaining it. And therefore, given that lack of ambiguity, None of these other unrelated questions were necessary to explain what was on its face an unambiguous statement. The military judge, in fact, bent over backwards to admit evidence which was arguably relevant to this question, namely in Defense Exhibit C, the Army credentialing form from 1995, which had a substantially similarly worded question, that being...
Are you arguing that it's not ambiguous, the question in Section 8?
Yes, Your Honor, we are.
Is that necessary to your argument?
No, Your Honor, just addressing it because the appellant raised it here at argument.
So let's say it is completely ambiguous. Is your argument the same as to whether the other stuff comes in?
If the court were to
say there's a Pew poll that's been admitted that says 50% read it this way and 50% read it that way.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does that change the nature of your argument?
Your Honor, fundamentally not.
The other stuff?
Your Honor, fundamentally not, because that sort of public referendum on ambiguity, again, circumvents the central issue in this case. It's not whether any old member of the public thought this was confusing. It's whether the appellant thought this was confusing and how that impacted her subjective intent to answer this question. Your Honor, proceeding to the issue of prejudice in this case, in the event that the court should determine that the military judge did abuse his discretion in admitting these documents, the government respectfully takes issue with the appellant's statement of a proper prejudicial standard of review and says that this does not rise to the level of constitutional error because the matters excluded here were not vital evidence. They did not foreclose an entire line of defense by appellant. Here, the military judge admitted Defense Exhibit C, which gave the appellant a lean but factual basis to make their arguments in presenting their theory of the case at closing argument that the Army credentialing form process created a situation where appellant can be confused about the context of this question. That theory was placed fully before the members. It was the members just ultimately looking at all the evidence in this case decided that defense theory was flimsy in light of the overwhelming government's circumstantial evidence in this case, which shows bookend questions answered by appellants in this case affirmatively in 1995, then with an inexplicable subjective confusion and loss of recollection as time goes on, the members found that unpersuasive. And in light of the weakness of the defense case, the strength of the government case, the government respectfully submits that any error here did not substantially impact the findings of the members, given the overall presentation. If there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude? Your Honors, the military judge should not abuse his discretion in excluding irrelevant lay opinion testimony and unrelated armed credentialing forms. The government urges this court not to permit the appellant to redesign the rules of evidence to contort relevance to comport with their theory of the case. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Your Honors, the appellant at this trial faced more than just the additional charges. In addition, she's presumed innocent. Her case is similar to the Cohen and Harris cases, which are Second Circuit cases. In those cases, the appellants didn't testify, Appellant Lowry in the Cohen case. And the Second Circuit found that when an erroneous exclusion precluded the sole means of defense, that the error was prejudicial. And we would stand by that rule in this case. In addition, the members were not allowed to hear the lay opinions offer evidence of their interpretation of the question, which is so important to show the reasonableness of this altered interpretation. It is for the members to determine the credibility and weight of the evidence, and in this case, that did not happen. They were excluded also from hearing or from seeing the 6 years of credentialing forms in the Army that the appellant had completed, which were primarily practice-centered. And so the evidence that would have supported the appellant's chief defense theory was excluded and not properly allowed for the members to determine and gauge the weight and credibility, which was their sole duty to do. That's all I have, Your Honor, unless there are further questions.
You may briefly conclude.
Your Honor, in this case, the erroneous exclusions of the lay opinion testimony, as well as the Army credentialing forms, precluded appellant's exercise of her right to present relevant evidence and to have a fair trial under the due process clause. The erroneous exclusions were not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Furthermore, should you find that the errors were not constitutional in nature, they substantially influenced the findings. Again, we ask this court to set aside the findings of specification 2 of the additional charge and order a sentence rehearing. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case is now submitted. We thank both counsel for your presentation today, and the court will be in recess until October 13th at 9:30 a.m.